Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring with a special hour-long Fight the Empire, and our guest is Mike Rupert, the author of Crossing the Rubicon and Confronting Collapse, and investigative journalist and a movie star and a musician. Mike, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Per, you old radical geezer.
That's right. Well, tell us about... Let's start off talking about this collapse network that's just been launched. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a project that has come together over the last, I'd say, 5 months it took us to put this together. When it became clear that that everything we had said about collapse was happening, it was happening at an accelerated pace. And what I became aware of after the success of the movie, which is now just unbelievably successful, I think we're in the top five of DVDs on Amazon, and in the country, just in the last week, we launched the DVDs, went on sale on the 15th. But I had all these thousands of friends turning up from all over the world who had pirated the movie, and it was very clear with the initial first wave of success with the movie that there are millions of people around the world in many, many countries that are very much aware that this is the collapse of industrial civilization. There's no denial or argument needed, and that we needed a way to talk to each other and to share information, because my experience traveling around the country, especially since the movie, is that there is lifeboat building activity going on everywhere, and nobody really gets how much it is, how strong it is, what kind of progress people have made, what kind of great things are being done from an innovative standpoint to build lifeboats and to relocalize both food production and all essential services. And I would go speak. I've been to 7, 8, 9 states and just got back from Northern Cal. And there's people doing things everywhere. And it very much became clear to me that the need was to hook all these people up so that we could share information, build a directory. That was the prime mover to launch CollapseNet. We launched last Tuesday. It's been just a little over a week, and we bring three different services to CollapseNet.com or CollapseNetwork.com. You'll find it both ways. We bring video and written updates from me. We have some pretty high-tech video streaming ability, which we're going to expand, so that I can comment directly as things happen. You have written messages from me as well. The blog, which is moderated by Janet Workin, which is the best digest of news gathered from around the world in one place anybody can find anywhere. And then we have this great interactive software, which displays members on a map, not by name or residence address. Nobody gets any private information, but the software in the map identifies people who live close to you who are also very much aware of collapse and breaks them down by skill sets and allows secure instant messages back and forth. But each new member, let's say they use a screen name of Rutabaga 12, has skills of animal husbandry, skinning, tanning. One has skills of permaculture, organic farming, one soil restoration, one... et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a way to network skills locally to really accelerate building lifeboats. When we launched, I had an objective that we would have 1,000 members at the end of a month and members in 40 countries at the end of the year. We did 1,000 members and 40 countries in 4.5 days. We're now in 43 countries with almost 1,200 members. So it's doing very well, and there's a lot of great stuff there. And it's been very well received. So you can find CollapseNet at CollapseNet.com. Go check it out, because I think we've really got a site that is going to facilitate lifeboat building everywhere.
Well, I know that the news digest is really good that Jenna puts together. I think she does a swell job on that. It's really very complete. There's news stories there that can keep you reading for as long as you want, you know.
Yes.
One thing you say is, you know, the collapse of industrial civilization. Now, that does not mean all civilization. It means a particular type of civilization. And so the question is, what will replace industrial civilization, hopefully?
Well, yeah, and it's not going to be obviously a one-to-one replacement. That's been made clear by everybody in the peak oil movement. And you know, we're all kind of reveling, sadly, to a certain extent, in the fact that in the mainstream media and even President Obama's speech recently, peak oil's out of the closet. It's been acknowledged. It's there. What is going to survive is going to be defined by the people who build lifeboats. The Titanic is going to sink, and there are not enough lifeboats. So not everything is going to be replaced one for one to leave a world that looks a lot like we have now. There's going to be a lot of dislocation. But the key to survival is local food production. That's the cornerstone of everything. But then it's to become local for almost all your needs so that within a small geographic radius, 5, 10, 15 miles, people will be able to sustain themselves to one degree or another. And that's the most important thing anybody can do right now. And what we're going to what we're fighting for, really, is to determine what kind of civilization is going to emerge when the dust settles. Let's say it takes 20 years to reach a complete collapse, meaning that each year that that comes is worse than the year that preceded it. 20 years would be very fast. But we don't know what the world's going to look like then. But we hope and we believe, and I'm thoroughly convinced from my travels all over the country, that there are going to be a lot of small local lifeboats that make it. And that's what's important.
Well, you mentioned President Obama's speech. What did you think of it?
I thought it was terrible, absolutely terrible. It was disingenuous. It was dishonest. It did not inspire confidence. It was full of vacuous promises that are never going to be met. The Gulf Coast is never going to be better than it was before. And not all the oil is going to be cleaned up. But I was most amazed by President Obama's confidence that BP would have the leak stopped by what, August, end of summer, something like that, or capped. That was the only thing from my studies of what's happened and talking to people like Matthew Simmons and many other sources I've developed over the years, is I'm convinced that the nuclear option to seal the well is on the table firmly. That's the only thing that could have given the president that kind of confidence. And it has been used before, putting a small nuclear device down into the basaltic rock, which is, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet below the soft sandstone or limestone, to melt the rocks and form a plug. So I think that's on the table, and I agree with Matt Simmons and many others, oil engineers, that that's the only way to stop this leak, because the seabed around Deepwater Horizon, there's not one leak. It's not just one wellhead. We've confirmed 3, 4, 5 leaks, because the whole area around the wellhead has become a ruptured boil, if you will, inflamed with multiple leaks from many sources, and the only way to stop that, because the oil is forcing its way up through fractured limestone over many square miles, is to go deep enough to get it at the source.
So, well, let me get this straight now. So the idea would be you get some kind of a small nuclear device and you get it down, way down below where the oil is coming out now?
Yes. And that can be done. The Russians have done it before, but nobody's ever done it at this depth. But I'm sure that that's what's being discussed, but you couldn't theoretically detonate a nuclear weapon in soft sandstone or limestone. You have to go down to the igneous rock. That's much, much harder, which is below, well below, where all the source of the multiple leaks is.
So it's like there's one main source that splits up into tributaries that kind of scattered all over the seabed.
Yes, and we know there are many more than just the one leak. Mm-hmm. There may be 2, 3 leaks, possibly 4, each spewing 40, 60, 80,000 barrels of oil a day. And that's been confirmed. Senator Bill Nelson of Florida was talking about multiple leaks. There's a number of reputable news sources and scientific sources who have confirmed multiple leaks. The biggest lie in the president's speech to me, which really disappointed me, was he was saying there's only one leak at the wellhead. That is absolutely not true.
Well, what if the nuke doesn't work? I mean, this could go on and on and on and on.
Well, that's the point. And this is a cataclysmic event for the Gulf. This is an extinction event for much of the life in the Gulf. It's not coming back. The use of Corexit, those highly toxic dispersants, was literally a cosmetic effort to hide how much oil was there. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what damage the Corexit itself has done. We see many reports of crops being poisoned all over the region, and that's because chemicals from the dispersant are believed to be in the air. That's the really strong belief at the moment. And so, you know, this is absolutely catastrophic, but you keep coming back to it, and the biggest experts who have been screaming on Bloomberg or smaller outlets that mainstream people don't watch have been saying the nuke is the only option for a month now, clearly.
Hmm. Well, it's correct. It seems to be based on the idea of out of sight, out of our minds. I mean,
yeah, exactly. You know, I don't think anybody will doubt that putting that kind of a toxic material into the Gulf is absolutely compounding. It's making the bad worse because it's certainly hiding the oil. And if you hide the oil, then how do you clean it up?
Well, you hear people talk about some kind of bacteria or some sort of microscopic little critters that eat up oil. Is that true?
Those bacteria are out there, but, you know, it's like taking a 150-pound man and putting him into a feast of like 1,000 pounds of food. I mean, the math doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that kind of griped me about Obama's speech that comes to mind is he's kind of, and he's not the only one, he's sort of blaming the American people for being addicted to oil. And in a certain sense, this is true. But, you know, American people are not offered a whole lot of choices. You know, they have choice of whether to get a SUV or a Prius, say. But they, you know, as far as they don't have too many choices as far as mass transit goes. Certainly in some cities. Maybe they do, but not in other places. There is no bus service.
Well, that was the other great crime of President Obama's speech, was to reiterate again this absolutely dishonest notion that, we're going to support all of this with green energy, which is absolute nonsense. My book proves that, the Confronting Collapse, which is doing very well. The movie shows that. To me, that's criminal to tell people that everything's going to be just fine. We can continue growth. We're going to switch to alternative energies, which will not work and will not run 800 million internal combustion-powered engines that are on the planet. It's like I have zero confidence in the government now.
Well, you know, the green energy, I think we'll be lucky if it, you know, we know that it's not going to enable us to live the way we do now. And we're lucky if it enables us to live in some kind of a dignified poverty, I guess, or some kind of a sustainable economic level.
Well, what I have seen, Per, is that in some regions of the country, and let me just point out four or five specific areas, Martha's Vineyard, the whole state of Vermont, Northern California, certainly many places in the Pacific Northwest, I think some decent lifestyles are going to be very possible. It'll be different. It'll be toned down. I'm reminded of a great novel by James Howard Kunstler, also a close friend, called World Made by Hand, which is one of the greatest novels I think I've read, and it was so comforting. That showed a pretty decent lifestyle emerging, although in reduced energy circumstances. The big issue now, and what I'm convinced of, with a number of projections, computer models from universities, show that both coasts of Florida are going to be awash in oil in a short period of time, a few months. That the spill could coat the entire eastern seaboard up to Cape Hatteras before it turns out into the North Atlantic. Displaced persons are going to become a major issue. I mean, I can see 5-10 million displaced people coming out of the Gulf region within a few months, because of the toxicity, because of illnesses, because they can't eat. And I have predicted that a full FEMA activation will take place, and that this is a huge wild card, because when you have large amounts of displaced people moving and looking for a place to go, then things can really start to get shaky. And in the midst of economic collapse, I have been tracking for a year now that law enforcement agencies all over the country are chopping themselves to pieces because of budget constraints. The Minnesota State Police has a bill to cut their state police by half. Dallas 40%. Los Angeles is down to 3.7 cars per division. Baltimore. I mean, so when you cut back on essential public services like police and fire, and you have massive unemployment, dislocated populations, and many states like California are letting felons out of prison because they can't afford to feed them. It's kind of a recipe for social unrest, and I'm mm-hmm. pretty sure we're going to see a lot of that this summer.
Kind of like national suicide in a way. Well, we do have some copies of that DVD. First three callers to 231-8032 will get a free copy of the DVD Collapse. So first three callers, 231-8032. And if anybody wants to call this show, the number is 231-8187.
And let me say, Pear, that the DVD has deleted scenes and updates from me that make the film twice as powerful as it was before. The deleted scenes are me making many predictions that have come true since the movie. And it totally reinforces the whole concept of collapse. I was just amazed at the footage that we had done over five separate shoots that's in there now. And the message is so clear, nobody can miss it. Plus, they do a nice little follow-up with me in a human setting, you know, with a happy face on. And they actually play one of the songs I co-wrote with our band New White Trash. And I just couldn't be happier with Blue Mark of the DVD and the way all this has turned out. And the movie's getting a big, big reception in terms of sales and press coverage. I'm going to New York next week to actually do TV morning shows in New York. It's like we're cracking the mainstream.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air. Sean is on the air. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. How are you guys?
Okay.
Good. Hey, back in the 30s, when the nation was confronted with a Great Depression, the population didn't go run and hide in lifeboats. We didn't look for intentional communities. We joined things like the American Communist Party. Has there been some massive decline in testosterone and IQ since the 1930s? I don't want to run and hide. I want to organize. I don't want decentralization. I want a centralized, egalitarian, socialist government. And well, all this stuff about, it's like a survivalist sort of, it just bugs the hell out of me. Do you guys have any response to that?
Absolutely. Marion King Hubbard, when he testified in Congress in 1964, he's the prophet of peak oil, who has been sadly validated a million times over. When he testified in Congress, he said the big difference between now and the 1930s is that in the 1930s, this nation had unlimited resources and a population of only about 120 million people. Now we have 310 million people. Then we were the largest oil exporter in the world in the 1930s. Now we passed peak in 1970. There aren't enough resources to rebuild as we did in a New Deal era program. The government's going bankrupt, and it will. The Federal Reserve is going to go bankrupt. That's another one of my predictions that's starting to come true. And in the history of human civilization, no empire has broken up. It is always broken down. It has fragmented. And I think that the Gulf Coast incident is going to put enormous strains on that, because when you now have state governments all over the country on the edge of bankruptcy, Dave Patterson in New York is saying, hey, I'm shutting down state government here in a few days. Those states and those regions will no longer be able to afford massive relief efforts for other parts of the country. They have to take care of their own people. And those fault lines are very clear. No one from a sociological or energy, no one who has done the math on what it takes to feed people, to build roads, et cetera, maintain roads, has said that the U.S. as it is sustainable as a complete entity. The numbers just do not add up now, because we don't have the infinite resources we had in the 1930s.
Okay, we have another caller on the line. Joe, you're on the air.
Well, hey, good morning. How you guys doing?
Okay.
Great.
Hey, Mike, you know, I want to, first of all, you know, I'll let you know that I've been following your work and a lot of this work for quite some time. And, you know, I'm just really glad that you stuck your neck on the line, way back, about 10 years ago, and first got the word out. I used to follow you on...
From the Wilderness.
Yeah, well, even before that, they used to link to you from not just Portland Indie Media, but the parent site, Indie Media in general, back... Mm-hmm. I'm just really, really glad that you did what you did. And there's a lot of people that are coming along and following the same path as you. And I just really wanted to thank you for being the trailblazer.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you,
Ben.
Thank you.
And with that said, and I was on the previous talk show talking about this as well. You know, I've been thinking about it for 10, 11, 12 years, thinking about, okay, what is the root source of all these difficulties we have? And, you know, I've brought it down to just one word, really, and that's sociopath or antisocial personality disorder. Mm-hmm. Because I've been looking at all of us people on the left, all of us cultural creatives, we all scratch our head when we hear all these really awful things that happen, and we think, how could somebody do that? And we always come up with a blank answer to that, and we shrug our shoulders, and we can never figure it out. It's been this big, confusing thing to us. And since we haven't been able to understand the process of that's caused this destruction that we're seeing, we've never been able to deal with it.
Hmm. Hey, you got a question, Joe?
Yeah. So what do you think we can do to get people to be aware of the people that are causing the problems as a class, whether they be fascist or communist, Democrat or Republican, irregardless of the color, race, economics? What do you think is the one common denominator with everybody that is messing us up? And thank you much.
Okay. That's a good point, actually. But I would categorize it a bit differently. I said clearly in the movie, and this relates to the last caller, too, capitalism, communism, and socialism are terms that need to be absolutely thrown out the window immediately because every one of them assumes infinite resources. No one has developed anywhere throughout human history a working political economic construct that is predicated on finite resources, balance with the environment, balance with the earth. Now, when one says something like, "Well, this is a massive outbreak of collective sociopathy on the parts of the people who run the economic paradigm," then it automatically becomes something you can't treat. You know, you can't force Tony Hayward or anybody like that to go to treatment. And so I make a different distinction because I always come back to one line: until you change the way money works, you change nothing. There are two essential mindsets, and the evil, if you will, in this is the infinite growth paradigm, fiat currency, fractional reserve banking, compound interest, so on, which demands infinite growth. The paradigm thinking, if you will, dinosaur think, which is what I call it, becomes subconsciously wedded to that inner belief. A paradigm, as one great guy said, is what you think about something before you think about it. So I don't call this an outbreak of sociopathy everywhere. This is people who serve the infinite growth monetary paradigm or people who do not. And once you do that, then the condition becomes treatable because until we liberate ourselves from an infinite growth monetary paradigm, until you change the way money works, you change nothing. These changes are small because we have to live in the world and use money, so you cannot totally plug out, although I've seen some regions that are way far along in disengaging from the monetary paradigm. But that's the fundamental break, if you will, that I traced in the book Confronting Collapse back to the Garden of Eden. This is the biggest evolutionary choice in humans' history, and it's got to be a conscious evolution.
You know, I was going to ask you if, speaking about Obama and his advisors and all the other people running things, whether they really know what's going on or are they deluded too, but maybe it doesn't really matter.
Oh, when I watched the president's speech, I saw deer in the headlights written all over everything. I have seen a great many commentators, James Carville on CNN, others, many like it, saying, "We don't think the president has a real clue as to what's going on here," and that's because the dinosaurs of the old paradigm who surround him are incapable, literally incapable of comprehending the magnitude of the disaster and what it means, because they're colliding with their own inner accepted belief that more growth, more economic growth, blah, 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 is what's necessary to solve the problem because, quote unquote, it solved our other problems. And I was really ticked off when the president likened this to going to the moon or building the atom bomb in the 40s. Those were self-chosen projects at a time when the U.S. had infinite resources.
Well, you might add economists like Paul Krugman, who's really pretty good guy and everything, but he seems to think that we'll grow our way out of our debts.
Well, of course we will not, and that is dinosaur think. In the deleted scenes which have been added to the movie, I tell the parable of the scorpion and the parable and the scorpion and the turtle. And, you know, a scorpion can only behave in a certain way, and that's the people who are locked in the mindset of infinite growth and the way money works now. They are just not capable of responding or thinking outside the prison of the box they're in.
Okay, we got another caller. This is another Joe, Joe number two. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hey, thank you, Pear, for doing the show, and thank you, Michael, for all your efforts.
Thank you.
Bought a copy new of Crossing the Rubicon, and, you know, there's just so much, but the three things I want to touch on real briefly is, you know, until they can tell me how Al-Qaeda took down building number 7, everything is predicated on lies, and there goes your moral authority for all the wars and things. But getting back to this oil leak, I designed a plug to go down in the hole and wedge itself into the hole and stop the leak, and I'm trying to get some people to take a serious look at this because I know it will work, and we don't need a nuclear weapon. I was not aware that there are multiple leaks, as you just described a little bit ago. But,
yeah, that's the problem. And there really isn't a hole anymore.
They've got a well casing going down there.
No, they were drilling without a casing. That's what caused it. That was the ultimate cost-cutting measure that tipped the whole thing. Many of the survivors in the history of the well, there was one great interview with a guy who made it off the well, and he said, this well didn't want to be drilled. Mother Nature didn't want this well here. We fought it the entire way, and this well never wanted to be drilled. But BP was so concerned about costs that they were drilling now 5,000 feet below the surface of the ocean, and then another 16,000 feet, I think, below the seabed floor. And the casing is absolutely essential to keep the borehole from collapsing in on itself. And BP was down there at 16,000 feet. They cut costs. They pulled the casing up. They had who knows how many hundreds of feet of unprotected hole with soft sedimentary rock that collapsed in on itself, which then formed a temporary plug, which forced the oil, like if you will, pus in a pimple, to spread out through the soft sedimentary rock over many square miles.
That's what we've been calling this disaster, the big pimple.
I think it's a boil now.
Yeah, okay. One other thing that has concerned me lately, and there needs to be a lot more research done on this, but it appears to me, based on what I'm observing, that the core of the Earth is cooling. The molten iron core may be in the process of solidifying. We may be losing our magnetic field, which shields us from the solar wind, which preserves our atmosphere. And there's a lot of magnetic anomalies going on. There's an awful lot of increased volcanic activity, which I'm attributing to shrinkage. As the metal cools and reaches its solidification point, you get this massive shrink happening fairly quickly, which is causing a lot of seismic unrest. There's a widening magnetic rift in South Africa. I think we need to be putting nuclear weapons down into the Earth's core, one, to get rid of them, and two, to keep it molten for a little longer until we can figure out another solution.
Well, I'm not going to go there because the current disaster in the Gulf is already too big to eat, and we have to deal with the most immediate crises first. But I will agree with you on this, that if we were to look at the dashboard of planet Earth, every idiot light seems to be going off all at once.
Okay, we have another caller. Anthony, you're on the air. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, good morning. How
good
are
morning.
You? Good. Say, I agree with most of the stuff you're saying, except the part about choice, that people don't have a choice or didn't have a choice. I've been designing solar energy buildings and educating people on solar energy since 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a solar
business.
Beg your pardon?
I said, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I've had a solar business from 1978 to 1982, education primarily, mostly funded by Western Sun, which was one of the five regional solar energy places that Jimmy Carter was putting out. And we didn't want to follow Jimmy Carter. He told us it wasn't our oil, and he had a lot of options on the table, and we chose Reagan. And once we chose Reagan, and once we choose about, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you. Yeah.
Oh. And I think we do have a lot of choices out there, and I think we did have a lot of choices. But we don't want to make the choice because we're convinced it's not cost-effective. Now, we do have the intelligence to save ourselves, but it's not cost-effective. So, you know, that's the only sort of issue that I wanted to bring up with you.
Okay, there are...
We do have choices, and I think Obama was talking about how do we get the American people to get off their rear ends and make the right choices about what we need to do to save ourselves. There are lots of choices out there. I mean, in terms of cars and energy and solar and wind and all that, but we don't want to choose it. So that's all I really have to say. But thank you very much for what you do.
Thank you.
Well, could I just say that, you know, talking about solar, I'd love to have solar panels on my house, but I can't afford it. So I don't really have that choice.
I have my hand up.
Okay.
There are two problems that everyone in the sustainability movement, and that includes people like Professor Al Bartlett and Ken DeFays, all the great Richard Heinberg, my good friend, you know, have all said, and it's very clear. First of all, David Goodstein, Vice Chancellor of Caltech, and Robert Hirsch of SAIC, who did a commission study for the government in 2005, said, first of all, it acknowledges it takes 30 years to change an energy infrastructure and trillions of dollars. We clearly do not have 30 years. We waited too long. It's not possible to make those changes, even assuming there was sufficient capital money to invest in the infrastructure changes. The U.S. government's going bankrupt, and you just can't print money. That's coming to an end around the world. We're seeing that in Europe. The second problem is that solar will not power 800 million internal combustion-powered vehicles. And if you build new ones, there's 7 gallons of oil in every tire. It takes 15,000, 20,000 gallons of oil to make every vehicle that is made. There's no factories that'll do that, and we don't have the technology plugged in. The designs aren't there, and solar, as good as it is, and I'm seeing it everywhere as I travel the country, does not replace the 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy required for every calorie of food in the industrialized world. That's natural gas and petroleum. That cannot be replaced by solar power. That's why the transition to permaculture and organic farming is the single most important lifeboat building measure that we have right now, and I'm so gratified to see that it's happening all over the place. We just need to identify how much it is, where it is, and who's doing it, because it's happening all over the country. But we don't have the time, we don't have the money, and solar, there is no combination in any form of alternative energies. And right now you're basically talking just solar and wind. That's all that's really viable out there. Nothing will support the edifice built by fossil fuels. Collapse is still inevitable.
Okay, a couple more numbers. We have a couple more DVDs available. The number to call for those first two callers is 231-8032. Two more copies of the Collapse DVD, 503-231-8032, and the number to call for this show, which is Fight the Empire, and our guest is Mike Rupert, is 231-8187, and I believe we have Victoria on the line. Welcome.
Hi. Hey, Pear. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. How you doing?
Okay. A little amusement in our household, because when Anthony got off the phone saying we have choices and we don't want to make them, you immediately said you'd love to have solar panels, but you can't afford them. Now, that's true, but that's a choice you're making. That's what we're saying. People can choose to do some things which are economically painful. And if you want to shift the paradigm, we all have to shift the paradigm. It isn't just the big guys who are controlling massive capital. I think Mike's right about permaculture solutions. You know, I mean, we did this literally 15 years ago with our little old 1895 house in Elwaco. We weatherized it. We did a bunch of, we built a batch solar water heater for under $500. We pushed our electricity use down by two-thirds. There are things that people can do, but most, you know, it's not very glamorous. PV panels are sexy. Our culture is sort of hooked on something that is technologically flashy. And there's a lot of other solutions. They're really old solutions. Like Mike's talking, permaculture is the way farmers farmed 100 years ago. You know, so, but that's not very flashy. Well, I have never owned a clothes dryer in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I live at the coast. Now, how is it I get my clothes dry? I either hang them on a line outside, which some communities don't allow, by the way. You're not supposed to see people's laundry.
Mm-hmm.
Or I hang them on a rack indoors. I've learned how to judge the weather by wind direction, so I know whether or not I can put a load of laundry out on the line and have it survive, not get all wet. But all these choices come down to a very basic level. And the ignorance about solar energy is incredible. People go straight to the PV panels, the most expensive thing that you can invest in terms of solar, and that only is going to supply about 20% of your need, your energy budget for your household. It's for, you know, running the phone, running your television, running all that stuff. Actually, solar thermal has more possibilities, but it's not as sexy as having a whole, you know, roof full of these flashy things.
And there's lots of great construction techniques which maximize the capture passively of solar energy, which is great. Let me just make a quick point on this. I think it's a great point. Don't automatically say I can't afford it.
Right.
Push comes to shove, people will find ways who have the ability to afford it. But right after the movie came out, and we had the first round of initially rave reviews from Variety, Roger Ebert, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, etc., I was invited to be a keynote speaker at the Earthworks convention in Denver in May. And the message that I got when they asked, this was like in October of last year, maybe November, they said, gee, Mike, this is the biggest convention of alternative energy manufacturers in the country. But we'd like you to tone down your message and not be so dire, because we believe that that alternative energies is going to save everything in the economy, and that's what I call the green investment bubble. I got called just 10 days before I was ready to get on the plane and go deliver the keynote, and the conference, the convention had been canceled because 70% of the exhibitors had gone bankrupt in the interim. That is the way money works. They were caught in the economic paradigm of many of them traded their shares publicly. They were caught in the, you know, caught in all the miasma of criminal economic behavior. Not that they were criminals, they were victims of it, like almost everybody else has been, but they're out of business. That's because until you change the way money works, you change nothing. And so even if there was a massive conscious decision on the part of the American people all at once to convert to solar and wind wherever possible, to rebuild and whatever, there's two problems. There aren't enough suppliers anymore, and there isn't enough money in the system to fund those changes, and that is tragic.
Okay, thanks, Victoria. And now we have Magnus on the line. Hello, you're on the air.
First of all, I have just two comments and then a question for Michael. One, thank you all, KBOO, Pear, Michael, for fighting the empire, because it's okay. As far as solar goes, every life form on Earth is run by solar. So, in a sense, we are all using solar power. But beyond that, Michael was completely right as far as the collapse in my observations, which have been 40 years of looking at this since the Vietnam era. And the sooner the collapse, the better, in the sense that on the trip we're on now, we're looking at total destruction of everything. So, okay, we'll go past that to the collapse. Then my question that I have is, it seems that one of our most important aspects is the communication systems that we have developed as a result of all the crazy technological push. And Michael, how are we going to keep the internet and that sort of technology running in a sustainable way?
That's a $64 million question. When we started collapsing that, and I need to stop just to pay a great homage to Wes Miller, who is our Vice President, Chief Operating Officer, to maybe four or five employees, and now 15 absolutely amazingly qualified, really high-performance people from all over the world who have helped us put this together. But when we started forming CollapseNet, I said, everybody start on the premise that we will have a functioning Internet like we know it for no more than 2 years. Now, I might be right or wrong, but that's the assumption we're working on. Now, we will not see like a kill switch where the Internet is here one day and gone the next. We will see progressive degradations in service. There's another huge wild card here, which is cyber warfare. And it's been very clearly documented that China launched massive attacks against Google. And we all know that twice last year. But they also attacked the Indian IT infrastructure. And cyber war is a huge front and center issue all over the world right now, because it's clear that there's going to be fighting. And we might all nuke ourselves. I mean, we have many options over which to do it. We have Korea. We have Israel, Palestine, Turkey. We have Iran. We have Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, you know. So laying aside those issues, what I'm instructing everybody in our company to do, which we're going to do over a period of time, is everybody needs to, because the cyber attacks will come against the largest providers, AOL, Google, you know, Time Warner, you know, the biggest providers. That's where the attacks have been directed so far. So one immediate step to protect yourself for email and data transmission is to get off of those big servers that are the big targets with bullseyes on them for cyber warfare. That's something that you can do to help protect. But communication is going to be a big issue. As CollapseNet grows and as we establish a worldwide presence and as we get into actually more TV programming and news programming focused solely on lifeboat building, we're going to go to things like ham radio. We're going to go to things like shortwave. We are going to build in redundancy so that we have other means of communicating with our members around the world. That's important. But that's, again, why relocalization is so important. I can't communicate with people who are 5, 10, 15 miles from where I live, 20 miles from where I live. Communicating with people in New York, Texas, wherever, is going to become much more difficult.
Okay, we have Kyle on the line. Hi, Kyle, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Sure.
We got you.
Yeah, hi, Michael and Pierre. Pierre, thank you very much for being there and doing what you do.
You're welcome.
Michael, thank you especially because you were the one person along, and then Al Gore came along after that, but you were the one person who tipped me towards, not always been interested in solar panels, to putting solar panels on my house, and I did. And I have a hot water system and a PV system. And
good for you.
Contrary to popular belief, possibly by that one other woman, I have to say that, you know, what I've done is I've gotten to the point now where I'm at net zero. I paid, well, really close to net zero on my electricity because I've done the work in the house inside to reduce my electrical needs, and including, what's a very good idea, getting rid of the clothes dryer. So that was one of the things I wanted to say. Hey, thank you very much. You were one of the people that really helped me to make that decision to do that. And by the way, everybody that asked me about photovoltaic panels, they always say, "Geez, when's it going to pay for itself?" And my answer to them was, it paid for itself the very minute I put them on my home, because my home is now worth far more money because I have these systems on my home. And second off, the federal government and the state government have given me that money back. So really, it really pays off in the end. And a system that I laid out about almost $30,000 for, I have paid about $12,000 or $13,000 for in the end. That's what it cost me, and it's paying me back every day now. So again, thank you for that. And a question I had for Michael is, and there's so many things I could go into here because I just love listening to you, and there's so many directions you can go off with this topic. But there is, and I hate to mention another channel or another TV station or something, but there's a program coming on, and I think needs to be watched It bears watching anyway, and it has your name. It has the name Rubicon.
Yeah, is that on AMC?
It's on AMC. It starts August 1st.
That's a ripoff, by the way.
Is it?
I mean, it's my lawyer's going to be having some conversations with AMC, but we can deal with that later.
Well, anyway, the show itself is really basically surrounds the big money that pushes the government that we have, our puppet government that we have, which basically it is. Into doing what they do. And I don't know, I just thought I'd mention it because I think if it comes close to even telling the truth about what's going on, I think it needs bears watching. But anyway, I just wanted to get on here and say thank you, basically, Michael, because you've really helped me to turn the corner and do what I need to do. And, there's other things I can talk about, I was wondering, too, let's put this as a question. How do people get around the financial end of it? It's like Per was saying, you can't afford it. And I would like to know how people can get around that more. I know how I got around it. I'm a custodian, and I own my home. And, I used financing from my home to the bank, through a bank loan to get what I got. But those questions just need to be answered, because that's the thing where people get hung up on, is paying for these things.
Well, let me add a dimension to what you said. And I was really gratified to hear all the things that you've done. And there are thousands of people, I'm meeting them all over the country, who have done that, tens of thousands. And they all say the same thing. And I'll accept the thanks for myself, but I really need to share that credit with everybody in the peak oil sustainability movement, which I now call the lifeboat movement. It's just much easier and it's catchier. But I share that credit with so many other people who were here before I was and who have worked so hard with so little thanks to awaken people. But there's going to come a point with the collapse of the economic paradigm where paying for it is really going to become a secondary issue. Because the survival issue is going to become, it's going to trump everything. I'm not one who at present advocates running away from your debts, because there's some pretty draconian laws there. But there's going to come a point where paying for it in the old economic paradigm is a secondary or tertiary issue. The fact that you've got it means that you're going to live, and you're going to be able to shelter or feed other people of your tribe. You will have a base of stability where you can meet Maslow's hierarchy of needs, so to speak, and share that with your neighbors. And that's the most important thing right now. Get it. Just get it and get it in.
Well, I got a quick question here. I haven't seen it raised a lot until just recently. Saudi Prince Turkey has warned the royal family they better get out while they can before there's a change of regime change. What do you think of that?
Well, I predicted that in the movie. And actually, I predicted it in Crossing the Rubicon, which came out now 6 years ago. And of course, from the Wilderness readers, will all remember that I was talking about the fact that this day would come. It's very clear that Saudi has passed peak. And the massive instability in the region is just exploding, because now Turkey is shifting alliances with now moving towards Syria and Iran. And I made it very clear that at the time I was convinced in 2004, let's say, that the U.S. military had a plan to partition Saudi Arabia, because all Saudi oil is in a pretty limited geographic area in the eastern side of the country. But I don't think the U.S. military now has it stretched too thin. I don't think we can protect all those oil fields on top of Afghanistan, Iraq, and now the Gulf. Which
and Kyrgyzstan, too.
Kyrgyzstan, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
This is the collapse of industrial civilization. So, and when the Saudi government goes, that's going to be as big an event as the Gulf oil spill, because Saudi Arabia, even though they have passed peak, still have 25% of the known oil reserves on the planet.
Wow. Okay, now we have Stevie Ray on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Mike and Per, I was wondering if you have heard of Paul Grignon's documentary called Money as Debt. That film really helped me understand the economic side of this. But when I left my parents' house when I was a kid, I became, a train-hopping scumbag. And you got your crew change, and you got your good army surplus sleeping bag that stays warm when it's wet, and got your Alice pack. You put cardboard in your shoes if they get wet. I'm learning how to do permaculture and stuff, but for somebody like me that's so adamant about getting people to work as a unit in my small area, you know, we go to one green world to get all of the vines that grow vertically, so we've got all of our nutrients for the drying of the wintertime foods and stuff, but what else should I be doing? And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Okay. I would think that the best thing you can do now, because this is something that I have not been able to absorb with my head, is because I get buried when I travel for appearances now, and I'm doing that a lot. I mean, now it's I have a celebrity status, which I don't really enjoy, but I'm too busy signing autographs and answering questions. But every place I go, I get handed 15, 20 business cards, brochures of people who are doing all kinds of things I'd never even thought of. And I think you will find the best answer through CollapseNet, because if you can become a member, and we have barter memberships available where people who don't have money can help out the network by providing us information on who's doing what so that we can map it, plot it, and hook people up and help them to network through our software, is to hook up with CollapseNet, identify the people around you who are doing things, and then coordinate with them, because everybody asks the same question, what should I do? And there is no one answer that will apply to somebody in Martha's Vineyard, Vermont, Minnesota, Washington, D.C., whatever. Every response has to be tailored to the needs of your own geographic location and your own locality. Because sometimes applying solutions from someplace else won't work where you are. But this is where you can network, and then you can find through CollapseNet, you will be able to find, as our maps continue to populate, people close by who are doing things. You can commune with them. Okay, well, he's doing this and she's doing this, and they have this skill set and I have this. We need to do this. And then from a tribal approach, then from a community approach, you can more easily find the things that strengthen everybody who's in your lifeboat.
I think we got two more calls. Let's see if we can get them in. Let's see. Next one up, Jim. Jim, you're on the line. Can you make it brief?
Yes. You were talking about the economic construct or the economic paradigm. It seems to me that the economic paradigm is merely a human construct laid over the biological paradigm. And until you can control the biological paradigm of growth, you can't do anything about the economic paradigm.
Good science.
Pardon?
Good science. Yes, I'm with you all the way. Go ahead. Keep talking.
Well, in your program that I've heard so far and anyone else, I don't hear any discussions of population control. And
okay.
To me, it's kind of the Earth is a floating Petri dish in my mind.
One of the great lights of the peak oil sustainability movement, visionary, was Richard Duncan, Ph.D., who's up in Oregon. And I tip my hat to him every time I can. He wrote The Road to the Old Divide Gorge, which in 2001 was the one paper that explained it for me in crystal clear detail. And I was talking to Richard Duncan once, and this was many years ago, and he said, I can sum up every problem that's happening right now in one word, overpopulation, which is true. Now, it is several things are clear. Which is the elites. Martha's Vineyard's a classic example. Are buying 100, 200-acre estates, walling them off on Martha's Vineyard, and employing the locals as serf. The clock's rolling back toward feudalism. There will be a die-off. That is inevitable. I'm not arguing for it or against it. It's the science is abundantly clear, whether it's bacteria in a Petri dish or caribou. We have a population bubble. The issue of consciously addressing how to reduce the human population in an equitable, fair way is the issue that's needed to be on the table. I started calling for it in 2002. Many others were ahead of me. What's happening now is a de facto die-off where the rich are just saying, let them sort themselves out. Let them eat cake. Let them die off, because the elites are not going to put any money into housing millions of displaced people because they can't afford it. It'll be a situation like the Dust Bowl in the 30s, where you have this unemployed, starving workforce that'll transport itself from one part of the country to another to provide cheap labor. And if some of them die along the way, well, that's just genetics or, you know, whatever. That's the attitude. That's not my attitude that the elites have. But overpopulation, you know, as Richard Heinberg clearly wrote, we're at peak everything, and fresh water probably right behind oil is the biggest shortage. And that's the source of most of the troubles in the Middle East right now, is the population growth around Israel, Palestine, and that region has so tapped fresh water supplies that that really a lot of these wars and the occupied territories are about water control.
Okay, I think we are going to have to end it there. The calls keep coming in, but the hour is up. And thanks, Mike Rupert. We've been talking with Mike Rupert now, who has started a new venture called Collapse Net. Look it up. Thanks, Mike, for being with us.
Pear, thank you, and I have to say hi to my best friend up there, Lisa Mann, the best blues player, bass player, and blues singer in the world, but she's up there in Portland, and I look forward to being at Duff's Garage for some more blues next time I'm up there.
Oh, hi, Lisa, and Fran says hi to you.
Oh, hi, everybody.
Okay.
I love Portland.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Mike Rupert, and this is the end of Fight the Empire for today, and stay tuned for Air Cascadia.